Our subject this morning is the obstacles on the spiritual path and how to overcome them. Patanjali, the great exponent of yoga, lists the major obstacles, some of which are disease, dullness, doubt, missing the point, hallucinations, lack of devotion to high things. All of these things individually are important to understand. For example, a lot of the religious approach in the West has been almost to court illness. And yet illness is very difficult to meditate if the body is ill. Yes, if you're ill, you should make the best of it. But to keep the body in a state of suffering in order to do penance makes it very difficult to keep the mind on higher things. The dullness of the mind is something that everybody at one time or another has experienced. You find that you sit to meditate and it just won't come. I mentioned one period like that in my book, The Path, where every time I sat to meditate, I would go to sleep. And I got so furious with myself. One day, I had been feeling especially inspired and was looking forward to meditating that evening. And just from sheer force of habit, the moment I sat to meditate, I began nodding again. And I was so angry with myself that I said, all right, if you want to sleep like this, I won't let you sleep at all. And I drank coffee and ran around and typed letters and did everything I could to stay awake all night. And the next day, I went to work with everybody in the monastery and didn't sleep again until the following evening. And it's as if my mind had said, all right, if you're serious, I won't. I was only kidding, never mind. And from then on, I didn't have any trouble for many, many months afterwards. Sometimes you need to do violence to your mind. Sometimes you have to chant. Sometimes you have to do some exercises, deep breathing, whatever it might be. But dullness is one of the things that we all have to contend with at one time or another because of the toxins in the body, because of the habit of the mind, which is sort of like a mule, that it'll move for a while and then suddenly it'll stop. And no matter how much you hit it, it just won't move. And finally, after it's had its little stop and its little rebellion, then it starts to move again and goes along with what you want. But you have to sometimes let the mind play out its own little rebellion. You can't just drive it all the time or it will break down under you. And missing the point is a very clear thing, which I noticed you all laughed when I said. It's something that we find people doing, unfortunately, all the time, because lack of discrimination makes them not quite understand what the path is all about. And they get all upset and excited about some minor thing instead of remembering what we're really here for. We're really here for God, and nothing should take the place of that. What is the point of even all the work that we do for God if we don't think of God? This is missing the point. I could go into this also as an individual obstacle at great length. Hallucinations are another major obstacle on the path. People think that they are having true experiences, but they actually are only suffering something from the subconscious, the imagination. This is, in fact, one of the universal problems that come along for the reason that in order to reach the superconscious, you have to go through the subconscious. In meditation, you begin to see images coming up from the subconscious, and they haven't any actual correspondence to the superconscious reality that you're seeking. There are ways that you can tell whether these experiences that you have are real or not. One is that they, if they're real, they will give you a sense of very deep, calm joy. Not an excited joy. You can whip yourself up into excitement, and then you think, oh, I have joy, it must be from God. But that's not necessarily true at all. Anytime you whip it up, it won't be true. The true experiences will be those which have a very... They're rooted very deeply in calmness, in peace. The joy that you feel then is that kind of deep, deep joy The light that you see when you see a vision will be, if it's true, a very clear light. If it isn't true, then it will be somewhat smoky, somewhat dull. Everything that is of the superconscious is clear and bright. Everything that is of the subconscious is dull and not very clear, somewhat uncertain as to its meaning and so on. And even though sometimes you will get through the subconscious a true vision, in other words, the true vision will be mixed with subconscious imagery, the part that is true will leave you with a feeling of upliftment, of joy. Another test of a true experience is that it will change your life. You will come out of a true experience in meditation, you will come out of a true and deep meditation feeling in some way uplifted. And that change is very likely to be permanent. At least it will be very long lasting in its effects. So always look to the effects of any experience that you have. If it makes you more loving, then it can be true. If it makes you less loving, some people get on the spiritual path, and this is in fact one of the temptations of yoga. Every path has its particular pitfalls. The pitfall of yoga is that it, by getting you centered in yourself, may make you separate from external realities and make you start feeling that you are better than other people, or that other people don't matter, or that it's good to be indifferent instead of non-attached, which is another thing altogether. And so this again is missing the point. People who get onto the spiritual path and they begin to feel that they are becoming very non-attached, become proud of their non-attachment. Pride is missing the point, isn't it? They become proud of their so-called humility. This is somehow missing the point. They become indifferent to other people, telling themselves that I'm a renunciate or I'm non-attached. They become irresponsible. They don't think about keeping their word or about doing the things that they ought to do. This is why Sri Yukteswar used to say, learn to behave. If you are on the path, this doesn't obviate the necessity for behaving properly in this world. You must learn to be able to, as Master put it rather wryly, run at top speed and perform stunts along the way. That somehow the path seems sometimes that way. And another thing is, and the most important of all, and that's why we sang this song just now, lack of devotion to higher things. When people feel that they have obstacles, it's mostly because their minds have slipped away from that devotion. When you have devotion, then nothing can touch you. When you're in the light, when you're in Om, when you're in the love of God, then all your obstacles, although they're still there, won't seem as real to you anymore. And as I've often quoted what Sharada Ma said, the wife of Ramakrishna, that if it is your karma to lose a leg and you're a devotee, you may only get a scratch. The karma will come, but you will be so magnetized that it won't be able to get through that aura of magnetism, just as rain can't penetrate through a good umbrella. And similarly, the bad karma that might take your leg is bad karma that can give you obstacles in your spiritual seeking. And this too, if you're a devotee, if you love God more deeply, if you remain in tune inwardly, then nothing will be able to touch you. Whereas it might have taken you off the path, it might have given you a dark night of the soul for months to come, it might have given you all sorts of sorrows and difficulties. If you keep that attunement and that faith inwardly, you will find that in fact it really wasn't all that great. And when you feel that way, you notice that your obstacles too don't seem all that great. I had an interesting experience one time many years ago. I was talking with some lady about the difficulties that people go through on the path. We were talking about different individuals and how they were suffering this and suffering that. I said, I think we were talking also about the lives of saints and how much they had gone through. Anyway, I said to her, It's strange, you know, but I just never seem to have any problems. And she said, no problems, my God. And she started listing the problems that I just had, the burning of our temple a few months earlier, and the threat to the land that we almost lost all our property because of a threat of foreclosure, and oh, all sorts of things. And I had to say, oh yeah, that's right, that did happen. But the thing is that I was in a period of just cheerfully building for God and Master and wasn't thinking about those things, and so they didn't seem to really exist. And this is what you will find, in fact, this is what the Sufi saint Rabia said when she was dying and was in great physical pain, and three of her disciples came to her and were wanting to comfort her. And one of them said, well, Mother, no one is he is no true lover of God who isn't willing to suffer for God's sake. And she said, this smacks of egotism. And so they said, well, the second one tried to correct it, and he said, he is no true lover of God who isn't happy to suffer for God's sake. And she said, no, more than this is needed. And they said, well, Mother, you tell us, what is the sign of a true lover of God in the face of suffering? And she said, he is no true lover of God who doesn't forget his troubles in contemplation of the Beloved. And in fact, that's how it is. As Master said, that you learn to stand unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds. Problems are not meant to overwhelm you. They're meant to bring you to that level of strength where they cease to exist. And if, as in fact happens, that once you've gained that level of strength, your karma gives you another level of problems that each time seem just a little bit bigger than you can bear, if you keep that thought in mind, you'll find that they all just disappear. They aren't that big. This whole life is not that big. How much can one body suffer, for heaven's sake? It seems terrific when you're going through it, but if you could just withdraw and look at it as just a little speck of dust on the scenery, which is all it really is, if you could get yourself centered in God, you would see that nothing is all that great, because God is everywhere, God is everything, and God is absolute joy. In the contemplation of that joy, you know, it would help very much to look at the lives of saints and see that those who knew God, not one of them, after having had the vision of God, was bitter. Not one of them said that now that he understood what it was all about, it was really a bummer. Every one of them said that now that I know God, I see that everything is worth it. All the troubles that I ever went through are worth it because his love, his joy are so absolute that nothing else exists. There is no other reality. It looks like reality because you're close to it. It is reality in the sense that it makes a part of the whole picture, but if you were to look at a beautiful painting and so up so close to it that you only see the shadow, then you would think, what a dark painting. But when you step back, you see that that shadow was necessary to bring out the light. And so when you step back from your problems, you know, you go to the movies. This is an illustration that Master gave us. You go to the movies and you see some terrible tragedy, let's say Hamlet, Macbeth, or some other great tragedy. When you come out, what do you say? You say, what a wonderful movie. What a wonderful story. I gained so much from it. There's a beautiful, one of the great plays ever written, called Riders to the Sea by John Millington Synge. And some people have said it's the best play in the English language since Shakespeare. He describes in a very short one-act tragedy a woman who lives in a family of fishermen in the Aran Islands in Ireland. And all her family have been taken. She has only one son. And he goes out and he's drowned also. And she says at the end of it, when his body is brought back, she says, now I'm at peace. I have nothing left that I can give, nothing left that I can lose. And now I know peace. And this is the effect of catharsis, that in the midst of the greatest tragedy, that there comes that time when suddenly you learn a lot. But when you suffer it yourself, it's different, isn't it? When you see it on the stage, you think, wonderful, wonderful. You go through a little bit like that. Somebody spills tie on your new coffee on your new tie or dress, and you get all into a rage. It would be good to stand back from it all. Learn to have that sense of mental detachment, which sees that it's all a dream. That's a part of it. But even more than that, be so in love with God that nothing else ever matters. Ramakrishna used a beautiful illustration of a woman who had lost her husband and cast herself in an agony of bereavement on the ground. But before doing so, for fear of breaking her glasses and her jewelry, she removed everything and then cast herself. He said many people are like that. They they pretend great emotion. They pretend total abandonment to God. But first of all, they want to be sure that everything's in order and that the stock market is behaving itself and that they've been thoroughly practical on every possible level. And then, oh God, I give myself to you and everything that I am. One eye on the door to make sure it's locked. And no, I'm not talking of this kind of, but of total. When the thing is that when you really are, when somebody dies whom you really love, nothing else matters for a while, does it? Your whole mind is there and you just don't want to think of anything else because you feel such pain. Well, then the same thing, why not that kind of love for God? That you feel so much love for God that nothing else matters. You will find that when you're really in love with God, nothing does matter all that much. You see it without having to tell yourself that it's a dream. You see that, yes, it is a dream, because you know He's there. And another thing you know is that it always, everything will work out for the best. When you love, you know, you trust. And when you trust, you know that things will go as they ought to. And you will find that with this absolute trust, things do work out, because the very greatest tragedies aren't really anything once you keep your heart in God. Master even said that the martyrs, those who died in the arena in Rome, for example, under the gladiators and the lions, those who really died with that same faith that they had clung to during life, they didn't even feel pain. God will protect you. God will make your greatest troubles suddenly vanish. He'll bring you right to the precipice, and suddenly He'll show you a staircase. And so, if you have this kind of love, how do you develop that kind of love? That's the most important thing, really, on the path in learning how to overcome obstacles, is not to think of the obstacles so much, but think more of how to develop your own greater strength. And this is the sort of natural tendency, apparently, of Americans anyway. So it's good to keep that in mind, just because this is what you've grown up with, this consciousness. One person, a general, said that the American armies in the Second World War, or in just by natural practice, don't have so much a tendency to think about the subtleties of where the enemy is and what its strengths are. They just think in terms of becoming stronger themselves, where the English are much more likely to be trying to think how to pit this person against that, and divide and conquer has been the rule in England for centuries, but with a very subtle kind of attitude, concentrate on the enemy and on how to diminish his strength. Actually, both are okay, because when you've got obstacles, it's just as well to know how the enemy works, the enemy in this case being your own, the devil within you, let's say. It's good to know his tricks. It's good to know how he can fool you into, for example, the story that Master told about the man who gave up drinking. And then he started thinking, well, now that I've really overcome drinking, I can have a few bottles here in my cabinet for friends. And then he said, well, now that I've really given up drinking, after all those labels are pretty, so why don't we just put the bottles out where I can look at them sometimes, they're all right. And then after a few months, he said, well, I've really given it up, you see, I'm not even tempted now. And so if I were to take a drink every now and then, a little sip, you know, just to sort of remind myself of what it is that I've given up, no harm, in fact, it'll make me stronger. And so he took a little sip, and before he knew it, he was a drunk all over again. It's good to know how the subconscious mind can trick you into attitudes that will be to your detriment, but giving you all sorts of good reasoning. It's good to know how the enemy works, but the most important thing of all is to have that kind of devotion that overwhelms everything. And not only that, but you will find that when you have that kind of devotion, the Lord will give you that understanding too. Because when we talk of the American armies, we're talking of ego. We're talking of self-strength. But when we're talking of devotion, we're talking of strengthening that part of us which gives us understanding on all levels. So that you don't need to really understand the darkness with the mind, with the subtlety of reasoning. All you need to do is be enough in tune, and the intuition will help you to understand. There is a very interesting case that frame of reference. The three children in Fatima, in Portugal, who had the vision of the Madonna. You've all heard the story back in 1917, I believe it was, or 18. They had this vision. They were young children. Jacinta was 7 years old, I think. A little child who didn't really know the world at all. Lived in a tiny village, lived with devotion, lived with the thought of God. Her whole life was prayer and helping others through prayer. But because of her devotion to God and the intuition that came to her through that devotion, she was able at that young age of 7 to give counseling to people who were old, who had many of the problems that only grown-ups have. She could understand them, not necessarily from the mind, but she could say that which showed a deep understanding, at least that was coming through her. And people, again, who have been in deep meditation, there was a family of friends of mine in India who went to visit the cave where Babaji used to live in the Himalayas, where Lahiri Mahashai met him. And Babaji no longer lives there, but they found a saint living on top of that mountain there on a plateau. And he was cut off from everything, and they were very well impressed with him. And they said, but how do you eat up here? And he said, no problem, and he just sort of manifested food for them. And anything they wanted, he could just materialize for them. They said it was an extraordinary experience. And then they asked him, somehow the subject came up of, he was talking English, I think, either with all of them or with one of them, instead of Hindi, they were Indians. And they asked him, how did you learn English? Because he had said that he'd come up there at a young age. And he said, no problem. If I need a language, I can speak it. And Anandamoyi Ma told me the same thing, that if I were to concentrate, I could easily speak English. The thing is, you get in tune with the essence of something, you get in tune with the spiritual flow, and then how God manifests through this language, through that food, through this experience, through that person's problems. You understand without reading, you understand without studying and thinking. The mind, as Saint Teresa of Avila said, in a moment of ecstasy, you understand something that it would take you many years of study to absorb on a mental level. But in ecstasy, suddenly you understand, because this mind is a very low function of who you really are, of your total potential. Just as when you go to sleep, you find that your level of thinking then is so instinctual and so unclear that you're really more on the level of the animals. You can expect a turtle to rationalize as clearly as that stage. When you wake up, suddenly you can see things very clearly and realize how ridiculous some of the rationalizing and the reasoning that you followed was in your dream state. You see a tree suddenly becoming an elephant, and in the dream you think, oh, well, of course, why not? But you know that that doesn't happen on this level. You're more aware. You can create a consistency. The difference between the conscious mind and the subconscious mind is somewhat similar to the difference between the conscious mind and the superconscious mind. In superconsciousness, there is a clarity that is much, much more, in fact, than that comparison. The consciousness of the infinite is at your fingertips, if you would just get calm enough to live in that. And the way, the greatest way to achieve that, is to have devotion to God, and in that devotion to uplift yourself in Him, and let Him think through you, let Him work through you, let Him solve your problems and fight your obstacles for you, through you. You will find that the more you can give yourself that way inwardly, the less your problems really amount to a hill of beans, literally. They're just nothing. Because you know that He is everything. So the greatest way is that. How do you develop that devotion? By service? By thinking of God more? By remembering Him all the time? By being with devotees? Being with other people who also have that love of God? Because if you try to do it on your own, the consciousness of people is a much greater reality than most people realize. It's the reality, in the last analysis, the reality of the individual's consciousness also. It's very hard, for example, here in America, for anybody to be a hermit. I wanted to be one. I wanted to start a hermitage. No hermits ever came. It just, you find that there's something here in the air that forces another way of thinking. And the thing to do is see how you can bend that way of thinking into something that will be constructive and helpful to you. But as you go to different countries, I've had a very interesting experience in teaching in different parts of the world. Because people come to me for counseling and they tell me about their own experiences, and I've been astounded to find that in different countries, people generally seem to have different kinds of spiritual experiences. In New Zealand, for example, the people there who were there, the stock was all sort of very basic common sense down to earth English. But they all had all sorts of experiences that could only have been there in the land from the Maoris. It was totally different from anything I ever found in England. And the same with the Australians. They had something that was somewhat in tune with the Australian Aborigines, dreamtime kind of experiences that were very interesting. In India, I would find that people who weren't even on the spiritual path didn't even have much devotion, but they would have experiences that you would give a right arm to have. Because it was in the air, it just was there. And they tuned into it. The consciousness of the people around them was that way. And I've seen it happen again and again that, I remember when I was in Germany a few years ago, and somebody was studying Italian. I guess it was Kirtani, because we were going to Italy, and it was either Germany or Switzerland, I don't remember, it's trivial. But we were going to Italy, and she wanted to know how to speak a little bit, at least. And so, she asked me a very, very simple question. No, it was in Bern, that's right. And we were going to Lugano, which is the Italian part of Switzerland. I said, wait till we get to Lugano, then I'll be able to answer your question. It was a very simple question, but where everybody was thinking German, I couldn't think Italian. The moment I arrived in Lugano, where everybody was thinking Italian, I could easily think Italian. And I've noticed this in landing in England. Suddenly, my accent, I mean, I know many people in this country think I am English because I have a slight English accent, but it's more sort of a universal accent. At least I like to think that's what it is, but it was English at one time when I went to school there, and I find that the minute I land in England, my mind starts to think more in an English accent. just automatically, that where you are, you begin to feel the consciousness. If you want to learn a language, if you want to learn a trade, if you want to learn a skill, mix with people who have that. Get into the consciousness of that, and you'll find you don't even have to study. It'll be there. You'll understand it. If you want to be a good artist, oh sure, it helps to learn the techniques, but more important than that is be with artists. Be with people who see things that way, and then you will start to see things that way, and things will come to you automatically. I found that when I'm taking photographs, I'm seeing things in frames. And the whole world just is full of opportunities for photography. And when I'm not taking photographs, I no longer think that way. And I wonder, well, gee, how can it ever be that I think that way? But once you get into it, suddenly that's where your mind is working. If you're writing, it's very difficult to lecture. If you're lecturing, it's very difficult to write. If you're writing music, it's a whole different wavelength, a whole different frame of consciousness. And it becomes very difficult even to speak. That's why so many musicians are rather inept when it comes to social converse. Beethoven was rather rude, and Mozart was not very good at just being a normal, having normal conversation, because his mind was in music. That's the only way that you'd think. You'd think that P.G. Woodhouse, who was a really great writer, you might think only a humorist. But after all, what's wrong with humor? He was perhaps the writer that other writers read the most, because he wrote so well. And he wrote so engagingly that you would think that he would just lay his guests flat on the floor with laughter, and yet he was totally inept at conversation, because his whole mind was sort of like this in his writing. But in his writing, he lived wonderfully, and all his characters come alive. But you will see that everything that you try to do depends on more than anything else, on the kind of consciousness that you are in when you do it, and then suddenly you'll understand how to do it. It's more that than anything else. It's like that artist that Master did a painting for Master, and Master wasn't pleased with the painting. He said, "How long did it take you to learn your craft, your talent, your art?" And the artist said, "It took me 20 years." And Master, who wasn't pleased with the painting, said, "You mean it took you 20 years to convince yourself you could paint?" This wasn't at all the kind of question this artist had been expecting. And he grumpily said, "I'd like to see you do as well in half that length of time. In twice that length of time, I mean." Master said, "Give me a week." And the artist thought he was just being insulted and walked out. In a week, Master did another painting of that same subject and did it much better than the artist. The artist himself had to admit it. How did Master do it? By tuning himself into being an artist. It wasn't a joke that he was saying. It wasn't an insult when he said that it took you that long to convince yourself you can paint. That's what it's mostly about, is convincing yourself you can do it, which is not the boasting thing, "Yes, I can do it," but getting your entire being together into that wavelength, into that frame of consciousness, onto that vibration, and then suddenly you find that you understand. And the skills that you learn, the rules that you learn, all those things that are outward, they are really meant, in more than most people have any idea about, to get you into that frame of consciousness where you understand, and then you can do it. But one of the things that help you to be in that frame of consciousness is to mix with people who are of like mind. If you are with people, this is why it's so important for devotees and people who are on the spiritual path to come to Ananda, and those who are in tune with our path, come here, live here if you can, but visit as frequently as you can, because this bathing of your consciousness in the vibration of hundreds of other people who are doing the same thing, and in the blessings of the masters that have been called into outward manifestation here, this has an effect upon your magnetism and your inner consciousness far more real than anything you can see out here with your eyes. But it's what really determines who you are and what you are, how you live in your vibrations, in your vibrational world. So you mix with other devotees, and you begin to draw their magnetism, and you begin to get into that magnetism, and pretty soon what seemed strange to you becomes natural. this devotion that we were talking about. You live with devotees, and after a while you begin to feel that love pouring up, welling up out of your heart and being offered at the feet of God. And it's something that if you hang in there, it's sure to come, but it's got to be with the thought of trying also, of course. You have to serve God in others. You have to give up the sense of ego. The street of life is too narrow for both the ego and God. You have to say, no, God, you take charge of my life. You work through me. But here we come to a simple little key that I wanted to share with you this morning. Because if we can bring our understanding of a subject down to some simple little device, then it's easier for us to sort of hang everything on that peg. It all becomes very easy, very simple, very clear, and everything fits into place, as it were. And this key was given to us in the Bhagavad Gita when we find in the first chapter the description of the various soldiers in the two camps, the two armies. Each of those soldiers represents a psychological trait. And what we are dealing with is not an entire population or an entire army of various outward warriors, but really with traits of our own consciousness, which in a very real sense is what we are composed of on a personality level. That is to say that every one of your traits, the obstacles you go through, the temptations you have, the thoughts that you have, the tendencies toward good and bad, both, all of these are in a very real sense personalities. And you are a mixture of those personalities. You are none of those personalities, really. Who is the real Lewis Howard or Rosanna Golia or Swami Kriyananda? Who is the real one? Not one person. We are a soul behind the personality. We develop these personality traits that make us have a good sense of humor and be good athletes and have a little bit of quick temper, be a little patient, impatient, or be patient, be kind to people, or be selfish, be serviceful, or grasping. All the various traits that go to make up a human being, all of these things are the result of actions, reactions. They aren't you. They are the picture you've painted while keeping yourself busy in this world. You don't come into this world with a clear slate by any means. You come into this world with many, many incarnations of habits, tendencies, desires. Master picked up a little baby once and nearly dropped it because he saw that it was an incarnated murderer. You see that little cute little baby, and psychologists will say that it's got a blank slate and we have to write on it. That's not true. How does it happen that one baby responds in one way and another in another from the very beginning? Because we have those things brought in with us. And even in a way, you can look at a little baby and see a lot more about its past life than you can when it's 2 or 3 years old and begun to act out the role of being a little child. But as a baby, you can often see in the eyes, in the whole comportment of that baby, an old man, an old woman, a businessman, a saintly person, a calm person, a restless person. It's all there. We come in with that, and then we add to it. It takes about 7 years. The first 6 years are still living partly in that old memory, and takes about 6 years for the new incarnation to sort of take hold and wipe out the conscious memories of the old. Not that all children remember consciously, but the tendencies that they have are still there. Like that story of Dr. Lewis, when his mother died, and several years later, Master said to Doctor, she's been reborn in such and such a house, and Dr. Lewis went there, and found a little girl of 3 years old. He said it was uncanny. The way she moved was so much like my mother. She felt an instant affection for me, and I for her. But her various, just her gestures, her smile, everything, reminded him so strongly of his mother. Well, gradually those would be pushed into the background and the new person would come out. I know a friend of mine said to his father one time when he was 3 years old, "Who was I, Daddy, before I was me?" And the father said, "Well, how do you know you were anyone?" "I don't know, but I just know I was somebody." And many, many children that I've known have had memories of having been someone before. The parents usually pass it off as a childhood fantasy, but in many cases it's not so. One friend of mine, he's a monk in SRF now, at the age of 3 he had a very clear memory of being brought up on the roof of a palace and having people play him music. And one time his mother came home with a piece of music and started playing it, and he said, "Mother, that sounds like something they used to play me." She said, "What do you mean they? I'm the only one who's ever played to you, and I've never played this piece before." And he said, no, not you. When before, when I lived in a palace, and they used to take me up there." In fact, he remembered being Rameses II, and it was an intriguing thing, because we know who Rameses was, and is. But if his memory is correct. But the mother was very worried and took him to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said, "Well, many children have this fantasy. Don't take it too seriously." But there are many such experiences, children speaking in foreign languages and so on. We come in with a great deal more than we realize. We are a mixture of what has happened to us and how we've responded to that. And each person was endowed with individuality. And that individuality determines your particular bias and how you're likely to go in different situations, how you're likely to be affected by them. And with that, you will go through the various experiences all people have gone through, being criminal and being saint, being at least good, being a businessman and an artist and an athlete and strong and weak and brave and cowardly and everything. But each person not only goes through these things, but responds to what he goes through in his particular way. And then that becomes defined further and still further and still further. And so you, in a way, get way, way out on a limb from who you really are. But all those traits that you've picked up along the way, not one of them is who you really are. You are that which is at the core of it all, watching. Not touched by it, not defined by it, simply watching. And the more you can get down into that inner core, the more you will be able to free yourself and be able to, after all, who is able to bring the citizenry to order? Somebody who's in control. Somebody on the outskirts can rant and rave and nobody listens. Get on a box in Hyde Park corner and give great lectures on how everybody in government ought to behave and nobody takes you seriously. But if you're the prime minister or the president or the king, then people have to take you seriously. And if you're a good ruler, then you can bring them into gradual semblance of order and they behave correctly. And so what you want to do is learn how to bring those citizens that are your own private population of consciousness to order. How to bring them into a semblance of harmony so that they will work for your highest good. And if you understand that every one of your traits has the same, really, literally, the same kind of reality as the people with whom you have to deal, then you will realize that you have a perfect tool, because that which helps you to work with people is that which will help you to master your own consciousness and to overcome your obstacles. Up here on the ridge a few years ago, there was a big fight that the local residents were having with a gold company. And they went down to the Board of Supervisors and they were giving their side of why they didn't want the gold company operating. And some people stood up in a vague way and they said, "Well, you know, man, when I wake up in the morning And I see those birds out there and I hear them singing. And, you know, that's what I want. I want to hear that. I don't want to hear a lot of machinery going. And to him, this was a real argument, but it convinced absolutely nobody. There was another person who got up very angrily and was saying, well, what are you going to give us? If we give you this, what are you going to give us? And so the gold company said, well, sure, it's fair enough that we tried to do something for you. And so they offered to help with the school here and with various things to make the life better for people. And then after that, they said, okay, now what are you going to give us? Oh, we don't have to give you anything. No, we're not going to give you that. It's perfectly nice and, in fact, perfectly right that you should help us and help our school system and so on, but we're not going to do anything for you. We're still going to fight you every inch of the way. Well, that loses friends and manages to influence people in the wrong direction. You begin to find that people who act in wrong ways don't get what they want. They may, and you'll see this happening again and again. Look at all the so-called Jesus freaks. I get letters from them all the time telling me how I'm going to go to hell because I haven't accepted Jesus as the only way. And if I define it in any other way but theirs, I'm still going to hell because they're the ones who are going to heaven. And so they all get together, like the Bandar Log in the Jungle Book of Rudyard Kipling, the monkey folk, that all used to say, we all say so, so it must be true. So these people all sit around and agree with each other, and pretty soon they're starting jumping up and down in unison, yes, 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 like monkeys, hoo, 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 hoo. So everybody else is wrong, we're right. And they convince themselves, then they get to heaven, and they found that heaven wasn't in agreement. Heaven had other ideas. Like in that what is the name of it? It slipped my mind right now, that delightful book. Was it Green Pastures, maybe? Yeah. Where Billy Graham died and got to heaven, and Peter didn't want to let him in. And he said, well, what about all those people whom I sent up here? And St. Peter said, well, you may have sent them, but none of them arrived. So you find that fanaticism or any way to... You find people, I'm giving you an extreme example, but you find this happening all the time, that people think that if they say yes loudly enough and voice their opinions loudly enough, that somehow that makes it right. You disagree with me, huh? Want to make something of it? Okay, bash! And so you're right, because you knocked somebody down. Well, it doesn't make you right, does it? You don't get there by just affirming yes, 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 and the more people disagree, the louder you shout. Your opinions about anything at all simply don't matter. And to put it in the proper perspective so you don't misunderstand me, my opinions don't matter. Opinions don't matter. Truth matters. And if you're in tune with truth, then you don't have to call it an opinion. It's fact. But it isn't because you thought that it was so that it's so. It's because you happened to see that finally you saw that it was so. And if in any way you get out of tune with that truth, you're the one who's going to be suffering, not the truth. The truth goes on. It doesn't change. And so you see bit by bit that there, and this takes, unfortunately, many, many lifetimes, because people keep thinking that they're going to get it together in some way short of the great sacrifice of ego that is required, total sacrifice, in order to enter into the kingdom of God. And so for many incarnations, they try to get it together in this way or in that way, and it doesn't work. Well, what you need to do is stand back a little bit from the crowd and ask yourself, what does work? Look at the people who manage to make things work for them. And you will find that whether they are worldly people or spiritual people isn't really what we're talking about. When it works, it works. And you can call it spiritual or worldly or whatever. It's the truth. Andrew Carnegie attributed his success to an ability to choose the right people to work with him. That was a very wise man, even though he was just a businessman. But it was a wise statement. Because when you can choose that which works... If you don't know how to do a thing yourself, find somebody who does and try to get him into it. Don't say, oh, that's all right, I'll do it somehow. Get the people who can do it well. You will find that those people who can make things happen for them with others are giving you very good examples of what you need to do in order to bring your own faults into alignment with your virtues. What do you do when you get, or when you find that you've got some sort of a weakness yourself? Oh, it was so nice just watching the birds singing and flying in the morning. I feel so good about myself. And it doesn't matter, I've got this, but that's not very important. I've got... You don't relate to that thing at all. You're not going to overcome it by just sort of snowing yourself. You have to face the reality. When you're having a board of supervisors meeting, you've got to address where those people are if you want to win them. You can't just be talking where you are. You can't just be addressing your subconscious with lovely fantasies. You've got to deal with reality. But you can deal with it in a winning way. Are you going to deal with reality by bashing it on the chin? Are you going to get rid of your faults by just sort of trying to knock them out? No. How do you win them? By magnetism. By saying, come on, this is a better way to do things. If you can convince somebody that this is better and not merely say that it's better, you're developing the kind of magnetism that you can address to your own faults and say, look, being selfish is, it's there's something in it. It's always sort of nice to be patted on the head and to get more things for yourself and so on, but is it really satisfying? Look at this. It's much more satisfying when I can feel that other people are to be complimented too for what I have done. When I can feel that the things that I have done I can share with other people instead of taking, I feel happier. And so you talk to your subconscious in that way, and the subconscious, just like a human being, that particular side of your nature will say, oh, yeah? Really? Oh, well, all right, why not? You know? And you'll be amazed at how your own subconscious will behave like a pack of people. Many of them children. Many of them opposing armies. But if you win them in the right way, suddenly they become your friends. And if you want to be fanatical and say, I'm right, I'm good, I'm not bad, and you don't convince those people, your subconscious, anymore. You have to listen to them. See what they really are. Don't try to snow yourself into thinking that they aren't anything at all. Whether it by fanaticism or by too much poetry or by too much just sort of pampering, learn to deal with yourself in a way, the way you deal with other people, by how do you win people, really? Magnetism's the most important thing. If you've got something really worthwhile, you can enthuse people with it and make them all go in that direction. And you don't have to ask them about, you've got these problems with your children. Is it really right for you to come and save our country? Well, of course it's right, because if you don't save your country, the children may go down the drain too. But you sit there and argue and talk with each person about his own motives for and against coming and fighting for your country, and you end up being invaded and subjugated, don't you? And the same thing with your mind. If you rationalize and reason with it too much, then you'll find that you're wasting all your energy and time and not getting anywhere. But if you will magnetize it in a good cause, that's why I speak of the importance of devotion. Because when you love God and when you love what you're doing, people get out of tune when they stop loving. People start feeling that the path is too difficult for them when they stop really tuning into God and trying they miss the point. They forget what they're really here for. They suddenly decide they want to be famous artists or famous actors or musicians or whatever it might be, and then they get out of tune. They miss the point. They forget. But if you can keep that love for God, that devotion, paramount, nothing can touch you if you always inwardly love God. This is something to remember, to write on your heart, because it's the truth. Nothing will take you down if you inwardly always love God. So then, with your various obstacles, to magnetize them, to have a good cause to work for, a cause that's self-transcending. And what can be more transcending than God? To live more in Him. That's why all the self-help efforts that are made without God don't really take people anywhere, because they're just sort of passing from room to room to room, but going in circles. And you see that with all the new methods that are out and all the psychological techniques and so on, it doesn't get people very far. They feel better for a while, mainly because they're doing something different. But after a while, all the old problems come piling in on them all over again, and they wonder what happened. It's because they've taken too small a cause. And if all the citizenry get called out to protect their country, and then you explain that it's from a cat, they're all going to mumble angrily and go home. And so you get all the citizenry of your consciousness behind a great cause and say that we're all going to do this wonderful thing, a primal scream or something. And you feel great for a while because you're there screaming primally. But after a while you think, my God, it's only a cat. What's it done for me? And all the citizens start mumbling and going home and taking up their old habits all over again. It's only the light that can chase out the darkness. It's only God's love that can chase away all the pettiness of hatred and anger and all that stuff. You can't change yourself, in fact. You can only change if you live in Him. So deal with your mind in that way. Deal with it jokingly, too. You'll notice that some people can only be won if you sort of smile a little bit, too. Don't take them too seriously. Come on, don't worry about that. Let's do this. Oh, okay, why not? You'll find that if you can just laugh at yourself a little bit, that your subconscious will be much more malleable than if you take it altogether too seriously. This is one of the problems with too much psychoanalysis, is that it can lead people to take themselves too seriously, when in fact what you need to do is forget yourself. You can't forget yourself if it's the most important thing to you, if it's that serious. You are not that important, really. Except as a child of God. But I remember a very good piece of advice that a friend of mine in college got from his mother. When he was a teenager, he was always feeling that people were talking about him and so on. His mother said, you know, you're really not that important to them, that they should spend all their time talking about you. We aren't that important, except as children of God. Then we are important, because we are owners of the universe. But in our egos, you could be the most important hero in the world, and from the point of view of the angels, you're still laughably nothing. Because only God is, and everything else doesn't really exist except as a dream. So all that importance ceases to exist. The way to work with your obstacles, then, is to work with them as you would with a group of people. And that's why it's so good to be with a group of people, because you begin to test your ways of working with them and understanding what works and what doesn't work. And if you keep applying that to yourself, you realize that this school of life that we're engaged in here is really the school of inner consciousness, the school of inner development. You need people in order to help you to understand yourself. And if, for example, in your contact with people, you spend your time complaining about how they're treating you, how they're behaving, how they're being unfair, then you haven't learned the lesson yet. Always think to yourself, what works? In anything that you try to do with yourself and with others, not what ought to be, but what works? What will work? Sure, maybe they shouldn't be the way they are, but how can you help them to be different? That's much more practical than just sitting there complaining that that's how they are. And if you think that they ought to be able to respond better to your golden words of advice, but somehow they haven't understood, maybe it's because either something's wrong with you, or you haven't understood how to reach them. You don't talk to bankers in fishermen's terminology, you have to talk to them in bankers' terminology. You don't talk to fishermen in bankers' terminology, you have to talk to them in fishermen's terminology. And the same thing is true with your own traits. Talk to them in their way. Find out the ways that they will understand. It's a very simple key and a very practical key to understand that you have to work on these yourself. But from what position? From position of authority. And what is that position of authority? The king. And how do you get to that level of being the king of your own citizenry, of your own population? Become centered in yourself. Learn Kriya, practice Hong So, do the Om technique, get completely centered here, and then from this center, without thinking your way through it, your thoughts are still your citizens. They're the ministers, perhaps, working, or the courtiers busily gossiping, whatever it might be. But you get back to the position of the king, and you will find that from that calm center, the divine will give you the understanding that you need to handle every imaginable circumstance. Well, I was going to sing to you, and I didn't, did I? Let me sing one song. And the fact is that I'm so out of practice playing this guitar that I'll probably ruin it all, but I tend to do things in segments, and singing is one that I haven't done now for quite a long while. Some men call it progress, down with those who doubt. To join the causes others join and shout when others shout. Come, you're a man, no passive stone. Stand up and call your soul your own. Go on alone, go on alone. Banish weakness, go on alone. Go on alone, go on alone. Don't look back, just go on alone. Some men lack the daring ever to be free. They shun the heights and cloud the depths and court security. Come sing with me. Come, you're a man, no passive stone. Stand up and call your soul your own. Go on alone, go on alone. Banish weakness, go on alone. Go on alone, go on alone. Don't look back, just go on alone. Cowards see but pride in singularity. Oh, never mind if men are wrong, so long as they agree. Come, you're a man, no passive stone. Stand up and call your soul your own. Go on alone, go on alone. Banish weakness, go on alone. Go on alone, go on alone. Don't look back, just go on alone. See, claim the power within you, error to defy. The world may change or disappear, but truth can never die. Come, you're a man, no passive stone. Stand up and call your soul your own. Go on alone, go on alone. Banish weakness, go on alone. Go on alone, go on alone. Don't look back, just go on alone. And one more song I'll sing you. Nightingale, nightingale, sing of joy through the I've got to remember these bloody chords, just a minute here. Out of practice. Nightingale, nightingale, sing of joy through the night. Teach my heart to impart every clouds. Teach my heart to impart clouds of gloom in no everywhere. Oh, teach my heart to impart everywhere your delight. Sing of moon rays on the rain, sing that love's not in vain. Every grief, every wrong, has its ending in song. Nightingale, nightingale, sing of joy through the night. Teach all men how to spin clouds of gloom into light. Without silence, what is song? Without night, where is dawn? joy must sing. Were it not for men's woes, who would smile at our rose? Nightingale, nightingale, sing of joy through the night. Let each tone silence groan, earth and heaven unite. Morning laughter, evening tears, snow and blossoms all fade. Joy must sing in the night to face change unafraid. Nightingale, nightingale, nightingale. Well, we survived that one, didn't we? And how, to speaking of obstacles, how would you feel if you were up here singing and suddenly found that you didn't remember the words? A lot of people would go all to pieces. But if you don't, then you find everybody enjoys it. And if you don't take your obstacles too seriously, you will enjoy them. As Master said, there are no such things as obstacles. There are only opportunities. And when you show yourself to be a bumbling idiot, you make friends with people because they think, well, then he's not all that different from me. So, everything that you do can be turned to good account if you don't lose your cool and just remain centered and think it doesn't matter all that much. So the next time you find that you're overwhelmed with some great obstacle, just say, oh, never mind, it doesn't matter that much. You'll find that it really probably doesn't.